1, 2, 3, 4.
What are the stories we tell ourselves to justify our actions in times of war? How can the arts convey complexity and foster understanding?
Don McKellar is a highly accomplished writer, director, and actor. He has written films including Roadkill, Highway 61, Dance Me Outside, The Red Violin, and Blindness. He won the Prix de la Jeunesse at Cannes for his directorial debut, Last Night, which he also wrote and starred in. He is an 8-time Genie Award nominee and a 2-time winner. He wrote the book for the acclaimed musical The Drowsy Chaperone, for which he received a Tony Award. Most recently, Don served as writer, executive producer, and showrunner on The Sympathizer, a television adaptation of Viet Thanh Nguyen's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name.
Don McKellar, welcome to The Creative Process.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know, adapting a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel is multifaceted and profound as The Sympathizer. It's a real challenge, I can imagine. You know, back in 2016, when I remember Viet Thanh Nguyen telling me that he did not think it could be filmed because there were so many, there's so many tonal shifts and perspectives.
Right.
That your film can't contain it, but you did it. You pulled it off.
I didn't know that. I never heard that he had said that it was unfilmable. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's daunting. Of course, the book is a great book and it's a celebrated book, and that's always a scary thing to adapt. There's the old Hitchcock adage that it's better to take a sort of pulp novel and adapt it and elevate it rather than the reverse. But at the same time, the book, it's so savvy with pop culture and referencing cinema and literature that it feels like it would welcome an entry into another genre, into a filmic genre. The hardest thing, I think, was the voice. When I first talked to Viet, at least to me, the thing that he expressed the most hesitation about was capturing the voice of the book, because he thought that that was the most distinctive thing. I think the reason for its success was the very unique voice in the book. It's told in first person with this raconteur who's very intelligent. It's satiric. It tackles big issues, and it's very lively and fun at the same time. And it's also complicated where it's coming from. It's a confession. It's written, in theory, under duress. It's very hard to replicate because it's very freewheeling. And we didn't want to weigh the show down with a lot of voiceover, you know, that feeling of a literary adaptation you get where you just have voiceover quoting the book all the time. So the first thing we did was get Park Chan-wook involved because he has a very similar visual language. We tried to replicate that voice visually, and we tried to come up with parallel visual narrative devices that would give that feeling that the book
It's really hard to analyze it because I was taken completely along in the ride. And there's so many cinematic elements, as you say, but it's woven. You can't like freeze frame it to be analytical about it, like whether it's the acting, the visuals, the writing, the editing, and the pacing. But also at the same time, you get those serious ethical questions about what is the point of any war that sit alongside the satire about Hollywood and America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at one point, Robert Downey Jr., he's talking in one of those many characters that he comes in, and he talks about the film editing process. It's saying it's more like jazz. So what's that hard work that, you know, we can sit back in the audience and we just enjoy it and it floats over us like music?
Well, you're right that it is very hard to analyze. It's hard to break down. If you took any 5 minutes, you wouldn't be able to sum up the series with them. It is this sort of bricolage of ideas. And I mean, it's a very clear narrative. It's not abstract in any way. But I think right from the beginning in talking with Chan-wook, we wanted this multiplicity of narrative voices and devices, because in a way, it's about how the story, in this case of the Vietnam War, has been told, what the expected story is, at least for American viewers, which they mainly know through the movies and through visual representations. And it's how our lead character, the captain, who is writing the story, who is divided and is divided loyalties, how he can capture the contradictions within that story. He tried to make that complexity part of the actual fabric of the show and keep it fun. I was speaking to Viet, who just finished watching the entire series, and he said, you know, even at the very end, the re-education camp and the grimmest part, it looked like you had fun making it. That was a real compliment, because we also wanted to recapture the spirit of the fun and the infectious elements of American popular culture and endow them on this Vietnamese lead and give them the same devices and the same pleasure that America has in their entertainment, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Even as you're telling some things with some characters, I don't want to go yet into Robert Downey Jr.'s characters because we're staying here on the caption at the moment. But even as it's telling a story that's kind of grotesque, there's the humor. There's so much packed into it. Even in the grimmest moments, we find reason to laugh just because of this beautiful production values as well. You touched on it there. Dualism is a large theme in the series. Yes. Not just in The Captain. I mean, there's so many betrayals. There's a lot of double agents, so to speak.
Yes, I guess doubling is kind of a big theme, and maybe it always is in spy literature, but maybe I think that that's why Viet chose to write a spy novel in a way and play with those tropes, because it's central, and I think it's central to the message of the show and of the book, this idea that there's another side to every question. I mean, that's the central quandary, this problem with the whole Vietnam War. It's saying to Americans, at least, put yourself on the other side, in the Vietnamese side, and then recognize that that side also has two sides. And then within that, there are further divisions. And if you do that, I think what it's proposing is that you have to step back. It forces a sort of objectivity and humility, and it asks you to step back and allow the bigger human questions to resonate.
Yes. And nothing is simple. Each of us carry within us the potential for good and evil. You know, it really questions this, our capacity for self-delusion and the stories we tell ourselves in order to overcome or commit unspeakable acts or just to survive.
Yeah. I think that one of the things I admired about the book was just its courage. At first, it seems like it's clear what his point is and the satire is about, but then you realize, oh no, it goes in every direction. It's sort of unafraid to tackle the big questions and poke fun at every side. And there's something very liberating about that, I think, because I do feel like right now, culturally, we're afraid to broach our barricades. You know what I mean? What I love about Viet generally is he's incredibly unafraid to provoke and to challenge preconceptions on any side.
Yeah, I think it's important that we should all be so courageous. Talking about charting those ambiguities, sometimes that's just kind of unspoken. So how do you broach that in your storytelling process?
I mean, I guess that comes through a lot in discussion. I just talked a long time, first with Viet, then with Park Chan-wook, and then we had a writer's room. So everything was analyzed. And I think part of Park Chan-wook's storytelling, it's very economical. We didn't want a lot of exposition saying, take a look at this and look at the other side. We didn't want it to sound like I was just talking earlier. So once we had our ideas, we really pared it down. We really tried to let the sort of contradictions speak for themselves by juxtaposing them, and then giving it space to resonate. So, I mean, I guess that was the philosophy.
And the casting is essential for that with Ho Ashwande. How did you go about, I mean, because you have to bring across his, you know, his personal charm and all this emotional depth. How did you settle on him?
Yeah, it was very hard because it's really all from his perspective. The whole thing is on his shoulders. He's in almost every scene. And when he isn't, it's from his point of view. And he's a spy, you know, so he's got to be able to have that poker face. He can't be on the surface. He's got to have a certain amount of control. So we had to have someone who was very emotional, but at the same time had a lot of control, who was very agile in a way, like the narrator of the book is, who is able to quickly change modes. And at the same time, sort of evoke the protagonists of American 70s action films, except from an Asian side, from the Vietnamese side. We always thought we wanted to find a Vietnamese Steve McQueen. That was sort of our goal. And yeah, we auditioned all around the world. We auditioned everywhere. And yeah, we auditioned him many, many times. We put him through hell. We kept him waiting for months and months because there were other good actors, of course, but he seemed to have that movie star quality, but also the intelligence and also the humor. He's a very funny guy, and that helped too.
Yes, and it's a subtle humor that plays in the eyes and all these little gestures. Again, I have to rewatch to understand. And I guess the key comic figure embodied in the four characters, the kind of four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Yeah, put that way. That's great. Yeah. Yeah, that was Chan-wook's idea early on. In the book, there are these sort of figures, these male white figures of American establishment. They're all different. They're all differentiated in the book, but he had the idea, what if we have one actor playing all the parts, kind of like Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove or something like that? And immediately we thought, that's a great idea. We brought it to Viet. We were afraid what he would think, but he said the same thing. That's fantastic. It really evokes what I was trying to do with the book. And it, of course, it's kind of a reverse racist joke about, oh, all white men look the same. But we also thought it had bigger thematic consequences. It's a way of saying, without articulating it or getting didactic, that all these pillars of the American establishment are connected and feed themselves, and there's something similar about them all. And it, Robert's characters, one represents academia, one represents intelligence in the military, one represents entertainment, and one represents politics. And so they're all feeding themselves, even if they on the surface have opposing political ideas, there's something at the root that is working together. It's a kind of deep state metaphor, I suppose. But beyond that, there is a sort of psychological implication that I don't want to give away the ending of the series, but it sort of comes together in a way, I think, that feeds into the captain's character too.
Yes, they're all kind of also mentors to him, malign mentors.
Yeah, they're all mentors. That's the way they are in the book too. That's one of the reasons we thought, well, they're all similar in a way in the sense that they're mentors. In a kind of tough way, they all assume that they sort of enforce that role in the captain. But yeah, at least the captain pretends that they're all mentors to him, or he acts that way.
As symbolic of America, that it's kind of the relationship America has with the rest of the world as well, a kind of sinister imposition of, oh, we know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this imposed sort of patronizing patriarchy. Yeah, I agree.
Yes. And it's so interesting, too, that so many of the key creatives in the storytelling process, many are outsiders. And you come from your Canadian production.
Yeah, it's true. And it's funny. It wasn't really intentional. It happened that way. I mean, obviously, the story starts in Vietnam and starts with Viet, and that's the heart of it. But then, as the show illustrates, there was this massive diaspora that came in 75, and as a consequence of the war, spread that nation around the world. And so when we were casting and exploring, looking for people to work on the show, we also explored the world. So yeah, I'm Canadian, it's true, and Park Chan-wook is Korean, of course, but our cast, Robert is the most American. I mean, Sandra Oh is also Canadian, and several other of our leads, Fred and Sui, are also Canadian just by fluke. It was no secret Canadian conspiracy, but we have a lot of Vietnamese in Canada. So, I mean, I think there's something wonderful about that, because it is, of course, it's basically 50 years after the Vietnam War, however you want to define that, the exact date. Past 50 years of American withdrawal, but it's coming up to 50 years, the end of the fall of Saigon. And I think that this idea of re-examining Americans' position in the world and American foreign policy is something that is, as you know, widely discussed across the political spectrum in America now. And that discussion began with Vietnam. So it does feel like it's about, in a way, American positioning itself with the world and how it has and how it should.
Yeah, I mean, it's just to put it in perspective, I think it's just a bit over 4% of the world population is American. And sometimes they forget.
Yeah.
Yes, but the footprint is large.
Very, very, very large.
And so, and I wonder, you know, there's so many great lines, but this might embody it for maybe a lot of the outsider creatives who are involved in the project. He said, I was fascinated and repulsed, the captain says, I was fascinated and repulsed by America. And his friend, the petulant captain, he says, that's what it means to love America.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that line. I really like that line too, because I feel that there's something true, and that's central to the captain. He might not understand that he is ostensibly on the surface communist and opposed to American ideology, but we tried to show right from the very beginning that he's also obsessed with American popular culture, and he sort of loves America. And those two dualities are inseparable. His opinions about America can't be unentwined, you know, and I do feel that that's one of the seductive strengths of America, is that even when it's at its worst, it's fascinating and absorbing. God knows that over the last while, the world can't take their eyes off America, even when it's horrifying what it's doing, what's happening inside that. And so yeah, I do feel that as an outsider, that's definitely up in Canada when we're perched on the border. It's like, we love it and we hate it. And Americans feel that themselves. So that's sort of a gift that outsiders can articulate.
Yeah, they know the entertainment value, know how to create the drama. America is fascinating for the rest of the world just because it's like an ongoing experiment. And there's, you know, on one hand, tremendous amount of ingenuity and invention, as well as some questionable high octane behavior. And sometimes it just feels like looking at a car accident. You just can't help but stare.
The spectacle, you know, it's also just the sheer spectacle. That's one of the things, you know, when you're making something that depicts war, you think a lot about the depiction of war and how not to glamorize that, but it's unavoidable. And that's one of the reasons why in our show, the congressman and Claude, they are all supporting the movie made by the auteur, even though he's a lefty and, you know, he doesn't have the same values as him, but they know that the spectacle of war that he is going to create is unavoidably celebratory. So,
and it will sell their cause.
It will sell their cause even if he doesn't want to, you know. Yeah.
We can't help but have an emotional reaction. And so tell me, because I heard there was a lot of improvisation. How do you, it has to be structured. You have all these strong rhythms and everything, but how did you make room for that improvisation with Robert Downey Jr.?
Well, I mean, there's not that much improvisation. Robert Downey Jr. definitely came up with some pretty funny zingers. He's very fast and sharp. But I mean, I think if you asked him if there was improvisation, he would deny that. I said to him, that was a funny line thing. And he said, no, I'm just doing the script. I'm just following the script. And I said, yeah, I know. No, and it's true. He did follow the script. But of course, you have to allow for that jazz, as to reference that quote you made earlier, that we have to allow life within that structure. Park Chan-wook's a very structured filmmaker and thinker about cinema, but still this hilarious moments. And Toen, the general, also came up with stuff that still makes me laugh, such weird moments. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's really the test of a good filmmaker is how they can create enough structure that's open, that provides openings for actors to live in it. And certainly we wanted to do that. We wanted our Vietnamese actors to fully inhabit it and for the whole community to fully inhabit it.
And so there's a lot of translation. There's cultural translation, you know, seeing from all these multiple perspectives. I wonder also, because you're working on the screenplays together with Park Chan-wook, you're writing, then it goes into Vietnamese. How does that complexity work? You know, you're having this unified voice.
Oh, you have no idea. You know, you said it. This whole translation is central to this project. Jaehan, director Park's translator, deserves a title credit on this film because he worked so much. But at every level, it's translation. And there's been so much discussion about translation. We have about 5 or 6 Vietnamese experts, from professors to actors and filmmakers, analyzing the translation and discussion amongst themselves. And then we discuss those translation. And then they're translated to director Park into Korean, and then they come back to us, and then I translate or rewrite them. So, I mean, I don't even know what it means, but the show is in a way about translation. Maybe this show is really about, in some ways, translating our understanding of the Vietnam War back into Vietnamese and then back into English for viewers. So I think there's something to learn through that translation, hopefully. I mean, it was fascinating for me overseeing all these translations, just seeing the complexity and making so many decisions. Like, this is an amazing Vietnamese idiom, but I can't literally translate that because it doesn't make any sense. You know, there's sort of questions. Like, we have the kids taunting the captain at one point in one episode with a sort of schoolyard rhyme saying, a half-breed is a monster with 13 buttholes. And it's like, well, it's not, it doesn't make any sense in English, except it rhymes in Vietnamese, and it sounds like something that school kids came up with. And so that's the kind of thing you want to preserve, you know? That, and that's what sort of gives it, I hope, that sort of richness that comes through translation sometimes. It's that sort of pleasure that comes out of cross-cultural clash sometimes.
I was interested in what you said, because on some of your previous projects, you've spoken about how Canadian language is more influenced by First Nations idioms in contrast to American English. And I'm very curious about the way language informs the way we see the world. And I don't know enough about it, but I feel like in Canada, it's less this relationship of domination and ownership of the language.
Well, I think generally, I guess, in terms of Canada, we are in the middle of so many things. We're sort of between Europe and America, our indigenous people have always been more connected. I mean, I don't want to idealize it, but right from the very beginning, there was more compromise and agreement. And, you know, like there were horrible mistakes in that too. But we didn't have the luxury of thinking ourselves as just like vanquishing the world. We never had that power. So yeah, in a way that distance sometimes gives you this sense of irony or this sort of different kind of understanding of the world. It's not unique to Canada, obviously, but I think it's unavoidable in Canada. Let's just put it that way. I always think, and it's often been said, that's why there's so many comedians that come out of Canada, because we just have a sort of little distance. And I think with language too, I think we were more absorbent. You know, I think we can use either the English or the American spelling, and we're sort of, we feel like we can go either way with language. So I do think we're probably maybe a little more attuned to it in that way.
It's nice, a certain humility. It's always nice to hear that. And so, of course, you reunited with some of your frequent collaborators, Sandra Oh, you mentioned,
yes.
Sophia Mori. You've, of course, you might want to talk about these other previous projects you've acted on.
Well, it's so funny. I just saw Sandra last night and had a fabulous time. And we were talking, as we always do, about our long history. And I want to make it clear up front that I didn't bring Sandra in. In fact, Viet said that his ideal casting would be Sandra Oh for Ms. Moray. And I said, well, I happen to know her pretty well. I think I could maybe swing that. And Director Park was excited by the idea too. So I gave her the call. And of course, she was thrilled. Then, yeah, I love her. And it was a pleasure to work with her, as it always is. But maybe that's a very Canadian thing about me. I just want to make it clear that I didn't bring her in.
Not all Canadians know each other.
Yeah.
No, but you memorably acted and directed her in Last Night, and yeah. Also other collaborators, Fernando Morales.
Yes, Fernando Morales, yeah.
He directs an episode of The Sympathizer, and he, of course, was the director of City of God and the film Blindness, which you wrote. What's it like to reunite with these different collaborators?
Well, I mean, I love it, right? I mean, when you work with someone and it goes well and you appreciate their work and you enjoy being with them and you think that they will inspire creativity on both sides. And of course, you want to preserve that. But at the same time, what was thrilling about this show was working with so many new people and finding new people, because so many of the actors in this show are very inexperienced. There's many who are experienced too, but it's exciting finding new collaborators and new people you're excited about too. So, I mean, I think when I go into project, I always want a balance of that. It's always comforting to work with people you know and love, but you still want to challenge yourself too with new people. And I had a lot of new people, that's for sure.
Yeah. So describe that when, you know, they have an inherent quality, but they just don't have as much experience.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, Tone, who plays the general, he hasn't acted very much. I think he's done some amateur stuff, but he was working as a graphic designer in Northern California, I think for Apple or something. I might have that wrong. And we auditioned him. I think he'd always wanted to act. And of course, because we needed so many Vietnamese actors, we really put the feelers out all over the place to community groups and all over the world, actually. So, you know, people who are normally in the loop were exposed to the possibility of working in the show. And yeah, there was just something immediately about him that was so unique and real that had the kind of absurdity that we were hoping, but at the same time, something sort of heartbreaking at its core. And I just thought, well, we could never have found that, you know, with a veteran actor. Well, that's not true. A good actor is a good actor. But I mean, that kind of thing was really exciting with this series, finding someone like that and just trying to let them blossom, give them the material, an opportunity to own it. And he's very connected with the story. He, in fact, came over on April 30th, 1975, on the fall of Saigon that we depict. He came over to Fort Chaffee that we show in the thing, you know, so he had this depth of knowledge and experience. I remember him saying to me, oh, one thing I really remember was the Wonder Bread, because we'd never seen Wonder Bread. And I remember, and we'd never tasted anything like that. And I remember the circle, the logo, and their sort of, and so I said, we have to get some Wonder Bread. So we have a couple of racks of Wonder Bread in the back of the canteen in Fort Chaffee at the refugee camp. So, I mean, that kind of thing is really exciting.
Yeah, of course, it might be something that passes by our eyes, but it connects them with their very real memories.
Those sort of details, you're absolutely right. No one's probably even going to notice that, but they have a kind of power. And when you know they're in there, they give it confidence to everyone, and then they allow the cast to own it.
Yeah, it's that little thing in the lining, the secret that carries you along. So, you know, I was wondering how, you know, what you got from this process, because I can see how different previous works might have been dealing with large spans of time, different continents, like you did in your screenplay for The Red Violin. And in this, you have a lot of complicated nonlinear storytelling. But this is, I think, you haven't really dealt with some, there were usually something that were a little bit hypothetical, say with blindness or, you know, something apocalyptic, but it's indefinite, but didn't have
right.
fidelity or authenticity. So what did you take away from that process?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a real responsibility, right? These are historical events. And just talking to the cast and our Vietnamese writers, and everyone has a connection to these stories. And they carry an emotional weight that may pop up at the most unexpected moments, because there's reality, as you say, and there's heavy events and people's lives were at stake. So yeah, there is a responsibility there. But at the same time, of course, the story is told from an extremely unreliable narrator's point of view. And not only is he unreliable, it's told under duress. It's basically being tortured out of him. So we all know that that's not allowed in a court of law. So as I said earlier, I had to allow myself the sort of courage to still be inventive or still find pleasure in history and in the most real of events. So it's a combination. Yes, of course, it's real. And we tried to be as accurate as possible with all the details. But at the same time, it's asking the viewer to reinvent history, rethink it, and realize that it's not as pat as you may have been told.
Yeah, well, it definitely gets across with, of course, all the, you know, necessary fun and satirical elements that allow us to face these difficult truths. And it's really, yes, as you say, it's all about the writing process. Have you ever felt through the many drafts? Because this is a book, a story about many drafts. Did you?
Oh, yes.
You're submitting it to...
No, yes, you're absolutely right. I thought that many times, resubmitting the drafts and getting notes back from HBO. It's like, I'm living the captain's life, that's for sure. I mean... It was a kind of torture at times, like any television is. But again, that just reaffirmed to me that this is the right medium in a way to be telling a story about writing and rewriting. And that's what television is now. That's where that kind of play is happening, I think, culturally. Like television is writing and rewriting, and there's a responsibility to that. But also, it's torture.
The sweet torture.
My name is Donna Sanders. I'm a master's student in English at Columbia University and an aspiring playwright. Listening to Don and Mia's insightful discussion, I'm struck by the 100 careful labors that go into adapting a successful novel for the screen. As Don aptly puts it, writers must walk a fine line between textual accuracy and invention, preserving the spirit of the original material while also incorporating new ideas and styles. I can only imagine how much intellectual and artistic effort it takes to adapt a novel like The Sympathizer, which is famous for its thematic complexity and its vivid characters. It's interesting to hear Don talk about the ways in which visual or filmic devices can imitate and enhance writerly moves on the page. In order to capture the unique, gripping tone of The Sympathizer, the series creators were obliged to ingeniously translate written language into language of the eye and the ear. I'd never before considered how extremely mutable good artwork can be. It reaches us all at once through a multitude of sensory complexes. The Sympathizer presents its adapters with a particular challenge insofar as it is an historical piece, rooted in a supremely complicated, vexed era. As Don says, period dramas like this one can potentially engage with the collective cultural memory in stirring and dynamic ways. They offer us an opportunity to challenge and investigate the often outmoded assumptions that we attach to particular historical moments. In this way, it's rather fitting that The Sympathizer should situate itself as a tale of spies and espionage. When we read the novel or watch the series, we become spies ourselves, peering into the past, examining private experiences, and reconciling stores of information which seem at first glance to firmly contradict each other. Don reminds us that even though historical works aren't necessarily based on the finished past, they provide ample room for creativity and experimentation. A narrative about the Vietnam War, or about any war, isn't just a litany of facts, names, and dates. When properly managed, it becomes a workable canvas on which savvy authors like Don and like Viet Thanh Nguyen can paint utterly original, relatable, and historically conscious portraits. Irony, sincerity, and deep reflection come together to create a new variation on a decades-old theme. These are important insights that I plan to keep in mind as I write my own plays and stories. Now, back to the interview.
So you came up through theater as well. You know, you've done everything, acting, comedy, directing. You need to tell us a little bit about that journey. And it's just some of these, we've been touching on them, but some of your notable projects along the way.
Yeah, I started in theater. I mean, I always loved movies. I grew up in Toronto, in Canada, and I didn't think the idea of making movies was really even a possibility. But I did think theater was possible. My parents, fortunately, were really into theater and into the arts in general and took me to a lot of plays. And so I founded a children's theater company early on and then continued that into university and founded a theater company, a sort of experimental theater company in Toronto. And then that took me into the movies. Someone saw a play that I did. And I've always tried to keep both sides alive. Even as I was making movies, I was still sort of playing around with my friends who I founded a theater company with years ago. And we wrote a musical, The Drowsy Chaperone, with my oldest friends who we founded that children's theater company with. And same time making movies, directing. I mean, I've always really sort of consciously sought out new places, new challenges in my career. Not so much because I'm so brave, just I feel like I need the change to keep me going. And maybe I have sort of attention deficit disorder, but I never like to feel like I'm doing the same thing twice. So yeah, I act and I direct and I write and, you know, I'm always looking for the next thing that's going to surprise me.
It's a beautiful way to be, and I wish that we could all have access to it. So many of us just mind this one territory. That's why I think that you're perfect for the synthesizer. I actually don't know how you are exactly attached to it.
How did I get involved in the first place? Well, Neve Fishman, one of the producers, he had obtained the rights to the book, actually obtained by one of our Vietnamese executive producers, is Kim Lee. And then he approached me because Viet had said that Park Chan-wook was his sort of dream director. And I had written a script with Park Chan-wook, as Neve knew. It was never produced. It hasn't been yet. It's called The Axe. It's a feature film. And I had a great relationship with him. We really enjoyed working together. And Neve approached Park Chan-wook and he said, yeah, okay, we could showrun it. But I think it was his idea with Don. So, I mean, he smartly knew that the amount of work it is on a show like this. And so then we came in as a team, which was great. And thank God, you know, I mean, I feel like we're real veterans now. I know that we make fun of the auteur saying that he'd gone to war making the movies, but I do feel like years from now, we're going to have war stories, the two of us, and laugh.
There's some we can't tell. No, I always imagine it might have been some kind of thematic similarities or how you like approach this. So I don't know, like your project about Glenn Gould, or maybe that was like applicable. I just see like some thematic similarities. Sometimes I think, oh, they choose you, but it kind of lands.
I say, like, well, I mean, I guess, I mean, presumably, I guess people always, if they hire you, I feel like it must be as a consequence of your work that there are similarities. I mean, I do feel that there are parallels for sure. And I guess it's unavoidable. I always feel like I'm coming back to the same themes. I suppose any writer feels that. So at least for myself, I often surprise myself at these thematic threads throughout my work. And yeah, I do see connections between this show. As you say, with 32 short films, even this film that I wrote with Francois Girard many years ago, who I'm seeing for lunch right after this. But anyway, that sort of idea of telling a story in fragments has always been part of my work. And tons of stuff. And I do think that that's sort of, I hesitate to use the word postmodern because I think it has a negative connotation now, but I do think my mind works that way. I do think I like throwing things against each other. I like juxtaposing things and using irony.
And what do you think draws you to these kind of extremes, the human condition under extreme circumstances, like we talked about last night, or blindness, that, you know, the characters have to really consider what is most important to them?
Wow. I mean, I don't know. You'll have to lie down on the couch to answer that one. But I don't know. I do feel, of course, maybe it's my experience in acting. You know, when I was starting acting, they always say, up the stakes in your head. The audience doesn't have to know, but for you, you will die unless your flirtation with this girl is successful. Something like that. You know what I mean? Old actor's trick. It's this exercise of imagining the highest possible stakes for even the most inconsequential actions. Just trying it. Or, you know, like seeing where that might take you creatively. So maybe that's a tool I have. Or maybe it has to do with childhood nightmares and fears and deeper psychological damage. I'm not sure.
And you've also performed, you know, notably Cronenberg's films, and your own films face, you know, considering the future, our relationship to technology, dystopias. And this,
yes,
you know, what are your reflections on the challenges and opportunities of AI, what that means for filmmaking creatively, what we should be protecting against?
I don't know. I don't have a really concrete thought about it. I mean, it's a tool. I feel like I respond to tools and I'm not afraid of new devices or even new voices. Even artificial voices might be able to feed what I hope is the human side of my response. So it's just terrifying possibilities creatively, but I don't know. I feel like we're still at such an early stage. I don't want to put up any walls yet.
Yes. Well, also, it's a very analog celebration, the synthesizer, I have to say. So it's not.
Yes.
It's not, and I don't.
Absolutely.
But I don't think that that was edited by other digital minds.
No, of course, it's totally human at every level. And I mean, the film is a show about contradictions inherent in the human mind. I don't think that that's something a computer would readily understand. You know, there's something fundamentally irrational about this show that I don't expect a computer would come up with. But maybe through an accident that a computer comes up with, or a mistake, maybe the human response would be interesting. That's all I'm saying. As a stimulus, maybe it can be of value. I don't know. I'm proud that my guild put up a fight. I certainly worry about the consequences just on a work level, on a labor level, and on a, you know, market level, but I'm not sure how it'll affect the creative process. I'm sure it will.
Yeah. You help us see beyond the binary. Just finally, in closing, as you think about the future, arts and education, lessons or teachers who have been important to you, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
Well, young people, I mean, what I hope, what saved me as a young person, I think, was that I connected with the arts and I was exposed to this sort of world of possibility. I think what I hope with children is sort of courageous curiosity. I feel that they have to pursue their creative impulses. And I hope that art can inspire them to do that. I mean, when I'm creating work, I always want it to be inspiring in a way, not inspiring like a Hallmark movie, you know, like not happy necessarily, but provocative in a way that inspires thought, inspires creativity. So when I see young people, what I always try and encourage them is sort of courage, I think. Courage at facing the world, not being afraid of the world. And I think that art can bolster that courage.
Well, you certainly have given us a wonderful example in your creative courage. And thank you, Don McKellar, for opening a window onto your imaginative world and your compassionate storytelling that invites us to re-examine history, revealing the complexities of the human experience and enrich our understanding. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Donna Sanders. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.